Okay, the next case is number 13-1544, Alzheimer's Institute of America against Avid Radio Pharmaceuticals. Mr. Marshall, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, the invention in this case involved DNA encoding the amyloid precursor protein with a double mutation at a very specific location, which is also known as the Swedish mutation. Nearly half of the members of these Swedish families got early onset Alzheimer's disease. The issue
We're familiar with the background. Why don't you get to the heart of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue was not whether there was a mutation. The issue was whether was where could a mutation be found on approximately 3 billion base pairs in the human genome.
The issue is one of standing based on an assertedly wrong inventorship.
Yes, Your Honor, and the key question on inventorship is whether John Hardy concluded that the mutation was likely on the amyloid gene, where, you know, whether he was able to identify where it was.
The key question on inventorship is that Mr. Mullen filed his patent as his patent application as the sole inventor, and you now have a jury verdict against you saying that that was illegal, that there was in fact joint inventorship. In the old law, joint inventorship, misstating that would have wiped you out, period, end of case. In the new law, you have an opportunity to correct that if there was no improper motive for doing it, as I understand the new law on this. Did you make any effort to correct the inventorship prior to the time you filed for this infringement suit?
No, Your Honor, because...
Did you make any effort before the district court to correct your inventorship during the course of the litigation?
No, Your Honor, because...
You have an invalid patent, don't you?
No, because we do not believe that there was sufficient, clear, and convincing and corroborated evidence for the jury to find that John Hardy was a joint inventor.
You think there's no substantial evidence in the record to support the jury verdict?
That's correct, Your Honor. John Hardy's testimony was essentially that he lied to Imperial College about Dr. Mullen's contribution to the London mutation.
Can I ask you one question before you go forward? Isn't it true that the only way in which we can review a potential invalidation under an inventorship theory is if there is, in fact, standing in this case, right? Isn't standing the predicate issue? If there's no standing, we don't even have the ability to review the 102F decision. Is that right?
There wasn't actually an invalidity decision in this case. There was simply a decision that there was a lack of standing because John Hardy was a joint inventor and AIA does not hold John Hardy's rights. Dealing with the USF issue as well for a lack of standing.
So I didn't understand the district court to hold there was a lack of standing because I'm confused. The jury found that Mr. Hardy was a joint inventor, so to the extent the district court held there was no standing, it couldn't. What is your argument?
My argument is that there was standing because Dr. Mullen was the sole inventor, that he assigned his rights to AIA, and that the University of South Florida never had any rights in this patent. And thus, AIA is the sole rights holder in this patent, and it had standing.
I understood the court to reach its conclusion on why there was no standing to be based on ownership notions pertaining to USF versus AI. Am I misunderstanding the lower court's opinion? Because that was what I understood the basis of the lack of standing to be.
Your Honor, the court held that there was no standing based on two grounds. One, based on Hardy being a joint inventor and AIA not having those rights, and two, USF having Mullen's rights and therefore Mullen's assignment was invalid.
So are you telling me technically now, if we were to affirm the lack of standing, that the patent wouldn't be invalid because there is no judgment invalidating the patent?
There is currently no judgment invalidating the patent. That is correct, Your Honor.
It just seems very strange to me because we have 102F cases, not a lot of them, but a few, right? One of them is Tanu versus IO Lab. It seems to me that if inaccurate inventorship were to result in a lack of standing in every case, there could be no case that ever invalidated those patents under 102F, and yet we have such cases, right? So I don't understand how the inventorship problem pertains to standing, but doesn't allow that it, in those circumstances, there would never be any ability to invalidate, and you guys could arguably, what, keep this patent?
Well, there are certainly circumstances where you could invalidate a patent based on improper or misjoinder of inventorship, where the employer, for example, would have had rights in both, so it would not have affected standing. But in this case, I mean, what we're dealing with is a witness who repeatedly lied and admitted that he repeatedly lied about his contribution to this invention, and then comes into court without any documentary evidence to support his story.
Well, for you to respond to Judge Moore's question, you need to impeach the jury verdict, don't you? That's a prerequisite to your position. If the jury verdict stands on the theory that there's substantial evidence in the record, and there's certainly a lot of evidence in the record about what these various so-called inventors were doing back and forth, if that stands, then the answer to Judge Moore's question is what?
In this case, AIA would not be able to proceed with this lawsuit.
But if it stands, is it open to you to correct inventorship under 256 when the jury told you you had the wrong inventor?
Your Honor, that's I suppose that's theoretically possible, but I think practically that's not likely.
The statute doesn't go into detail, so I don't know whether that's impossible. The statute says if you got the wrong inventorship, you can fix it at any time, as long as you didn't have some kind of improper motive.
That's correct, Your Honor. The statute does say that, and were we to go back and get whatever rights that Hardy supposedly has, I suppose we could come back if we could get over the USF issue.
I guess I don't know. There are questions of maybe questions of finality, but so that as far as the point mentioned by Judge Plager, if in fact the jury verdict is sufficiently supported on the record, is there anything left?
Your Honor, I think as a no, Your Honor, this case is not going forward if the jury verdict is supported. It is not.
The key to your case is you got to impeach the jury verdict.
We have to show that there was not sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict.
That's pretty tough to do on this record, don't you? Realistically, don't you think that's pretty tough to do given the evidence before the trial?
Typically, in a typical case, I would say yes. But in this case, I would say no. And the reason why is because this case cries out for corroborating evidence. You have an alleged joint inventor who repeatedly admits on the stand that he lied previously that he was not a joint inventor. 20 years later, he comes back in and he says, wait a second, I am a joint inventor because actually I did determine...
Was he lying then or is he lying now? How are we to determine that? The jury determined that.
You would have to have some corroborating evidence, and this court requires corroborating evidence when you have a situation where there's just oral testimony by an alleged joint inventor. The strong corroborating evidence is particularly important here because the contemporaneous documentation contradicts John Hardy's story. There's a serious risk of litigation-inspired fabrication or exaggeration of the type this court talked about in Sant Technology. And if you look at the factors that typically guide the corroboration analysis, they further exacerbate that concern. The allegedly corroborating witnesses all had strong relationships with John Hardy, continued to publish with him, continued to work with him.
These are all questions of
fact. There is a question of law, Your Honor, as to whether there was sufficient evidence to get to a jury on corroboration. This court can review that. If there's not substantial corroborating evidence, then this court can reverse the jury on that. And we had 20 years between the invention and this trial, increasing the risk of selective memory. You have all of the allegedly corroborating witnesses were all paid by the defendants or other companies that AIA had accused of infringement. Many of the witnesses, including Allison Goat and Henry Holden, had admitted on the stand that their testimony was contradicted by the contemporaneous documentation that they signed. So when one looks at the totality of the evidence in this case under the rule of reason, this court, it's our position, should not permit an alleged joint inventor to claim inventorship 20 years after he had previously denied it in writing with such limited corroborating evidence. The evidence is extremely limited. In addition, there was a complete failure of proof that Hardy's conclusion, his inventorship claim rested on his new story that he said that there was linkage between the amyloid gene and the disease in these families, and thus the amyloid gene should be sequenced. There was a complete failure of proof that that alleged conclusion was ever communicated to Dr. Mullen. Complete failure of proof. And as we know, joint inventorship requires communication and collaboration. It requires an open line of communication between the alleged joint inventors. Hardy himself testified that he did not recall ever discussing the marker data with Dr. Mullen, the marker data that would have showed linkage. Hardy did not recall ever telling Mullen that there was linkage to the amyloid gene. Hardy did not ever recall telling Mullen that the amyloid gene should be sequenced. Henry Holden did not ever recall telling Mullen that Hardy concluded that there was linkage and that the amyloid gene was sequenced. To the contrary, Mullen testified that no such conversation existed. Fiona Crawford, who actually did the sequencing, testified that there were no conversations with Hardy about the Swedish families or anything else for that matter during that period because they simply could not get a hold of him. So when it comes to joint inventorship, where you have to show collaboration and concerted effort, some open line of communication during or in temporal proximity to the inventive efforts, they have a complete failure of proof on that. Not even their witnesses said that these conclusions were communicated to Dr. Mullen. And keep in mind, Dr. Mullen is an ocean away from John Hardy.
Yeah, but they did that purposely, didn't they?
That is the allegation. But Dr. Mullen was in Florida 3 months before the Swedish families even got on the radar. So did Dr. Mullen go to Florida 3 months ahead of time before he even knew that Swedish families existed? No.
I assume he went for the sunshine, but he was also working for the University of South Florida on the same problem.
Well, I would like to discuss the preemption issue because the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the inventor's right to his own inventions is one of the fundamental precepts of patent law. And the district court here held that the Florida regulation, quote, effectively declares that the employee does not own the invention in the first instance. In other words, the Florida regulation, as interpreted by the district court, is squarely in conflict with federal patent law, as articulated by the Supreme Court.
So is your position on that point that the Florida regulation is illegal? That parties cannot contract contrary to the state law?
Parties can contract, and there are lots of cases dealing with that, but parties did not contract in this case. Dr. Mullen never signed an agreement agreeing that his rights in any invention would go over to USF.
Well, he has a release of rights.
He got a release of rights going the other way. USF released rights to him, but the regulation, which says that the invention shall be the property of the university, also requires him to sign an agreement acknowledging the terms of the regulation.
The trial judge viewed that as a administrative step that wasn't critical to the validity of this regulation.
Well, we would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because if that is not required, then that puts the regulation squarely in conflict with federal law. As far as
I don't understand how federal law has any business in state ownership. This isn't a question of inventorship now, it's a question of ownership. Supreme Court cases going back a zillion years say patent ownership is exclusively the purview of state law, not federal law. So I don't understand your argument.
You're right, Your Honor. The patent ownership is a question of state law, but what we're talking about is where does the ownership of the invention initially vest? And the Supreme Court and this court...
No, what we're talking about is a state authorized by regulation to create a contract in fact with employees of its universities. And I don't see how any federal law has the ability to preempt or prevent a state from enacting regulations, articulating or delineating terms of employment with its state employees.
No such contract was signed here, Your Honor. And the difference
is... Well, actually,
is
the contract was signed in October of 1992, and it said it applied to the period of employment from 91 to 92. So it's signed ex post, but it expressly says it applies to the prior year's employment.
Yes, Your Honor, but it does not contain the provision required by the regulation.
Well, actually, it does. At the top it says it recognizes and accepts all regs, rules, blah, 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 of Florida. It doesn't articulate with precision this particular reg you're pointing to, but the contract expressly says that both the contractor and the contractee understand these regs to apply.
Yes, Your Honor, it does say that the regulations apply, but the contract specifically says, or the regulation specifically says, that the employee has to acknowledge the terms of the regulation in writing. That wasn't done here. That would make this regulation consistent with federal law. Instead, we have a regulation that automatically divests an inventor of his invention. He never has any ownership of it, and this court has never dealt with that issue, Your Honor. All of the other cases deal with, for example, a federal statute divesting an inventor of his invention, which, of course, Congress can change federal law, or a foreign country doing the same thing, and, of course, a foreign law can do that within its territorial jurisdiction, or a state law which transfers ownership of a patent after the fact, but does not divest an inventor of his invention from the get-go, so that the inventor never owns the invention, never has the right to practice the invention. That is what is in conflict with federal law here. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
We will save your rebuttal time, although it's
thank you.
Mr. Lipsy.
Thank you.
You may smile. Nice to see a smiling lawyer. But in part you may smile because you think that previous discussion sort of teed up a great case for you in the sense that if I can just support that jury trial, and there's a lot of good evidence that I'm sure you're going to trot out first, you've got a winner. But let me puncture that thought for a moment by this problem that I have. There's a circularity problem in this case. You probably already recognized it, but let me see how you want to deal with it. The circularity problem is this. In order for you to win on the question of the validity of the patent, you have to stand on the jury verdict that there was a joint inventorship that was invalidly reflected in the application for the patent. If that's true, however, that means the patent was invalid, and he concedes that point. Mr. Marshall concedes that point. If the patent was invalid, then AIA could not bring a lawsuit on that patent. The trial judge couldn't have jurisdiction in order to hold a jury trial, which resulted in a judgment or a verdict and then a judgment that there was a joint inventorship problem. So you can't reach the joint inventorship jury verdict unless you can find some way to give the trial judge jurisdiction over an invalid patent. Now explain to me how you got there and how you're going to save us from that circularity problem.
I will still smile, Your Honor, because I believe there's an answer, and that is it's well settled that courts have jurisdiction to determine if they have jurisdiction.
Yes.
There were two independent bases offered for why this court did not have jurisdiction due to lack of standing. One was that Mullen was not a sole inventor, as alleged, and in fact there were outstanding rights which were not being represented before the court, and therefore there was no standing. And there was an independent ground
Standing is a bit of a red herring in this case, really, even though the trial judge got all wrapped up in the standing issue. It really isn't standing. It's a question of whether there's a valid patent to sue on.
You
can call it standing if you want to, but I find the standing concept sort of at right angles to what we're trying to decide.
I mean, in a way, what the judge did was cut the Gordian knot that was left by the muddle from this transaction. There was, I think we proved at trial that there were two collaborations going on here, one to discover new Alzheimer's-causing mutations in the amyloid gene, but the other to try to deprive these universities of rights.
Right.
And the judge decided to cut through that by saying, let's determine, there are lots of things we could determine, let's determine just, does AIA have the ownership rights it needs to even begin this process? And there were two independent grounds.
With all due respect to our trial judge, I think that jumps the issue. That's not the issue. The issue is not ownership. Because the question is there something to be owned? What is there to be owned?
I think, Your Honor, even an invalid patent can be owned.
Ooh,
it happens.
Really? An invalid patent is a property interest to be owned?
Yeah. Mr. Lipsy, if you were to carry Judge Plager's argument out fully, wouldn't it suggest that no court could ever invalidate a patent under obviousness, unenforceability, inequitable conduct, not enablement, because all of those cases would have to be thrown out for lack of standing?
That was where I was going, and Your Honor said it much better than I could.
Good. Go ahead.
So anyway, we have these two. There are cases, by the way, the Ethicon case is one that we've cited. There are a number of others where the absence of a joint inventor was found to deprive the party trying to sue on the patent of standing to do so. And it's that theory and line of cases that the trial judge was relying on. Now, the court having jurisdiction to make that determination of whether it had jurisdiction, and assuming it's affirmed, it may well have preclusive effect if there were an attempt by somebody who did acquire all the rights to enforce the patent. There may well be a question of whether the patent is valid at that point, although I agree with Mr. Marshall. I think the likelihood of that happening is near zero. These patents have all expired. If I may just briefly touch on the evidence, we feel that the acts taken in furtherance of the collaboration to deprive the universities of ownership actually corroborate the collaboration and communication on the inventorship front. We know exactly what was supposed to happen. What was supposed to happen is they were supposed to identify promising families. They were going to do a GT12 analysis. This is all laid out in the Athena proposal. If the affected individuals all had the same amyloid gene, they were to sequence exon 16 and 17, which is what encode the actual amyloid protein. And that's exactly what happened here. Dr. Hardy brought into the lab these promising Swedish families. He had his technician, Mr. Holden, do the GT12 analysis. He was given the results. He looked at it. He determined that, in fact, all of the affected individuals had the same copy of allele 13 from the GT12 marker. And he looked at it and he said that he had concluded that the mutation was likely linked to the disease. This amyloid mutation was likely linked to the disease in family 144, and that was abundantly corroborated by Mr. Holden's independent testimony, who testified extensively on that, and that he couldn't tell whether it was linked or not for 139, and that he then sent the material to Florida, which was, Your Honors, the step that was to be taken in the other collaboration if they had a promising piece of DNA. So that it, because someplace else is where promising DNA was sent in order to have the final sequencing done.
But
so that Imperial
would know. Is very narrowly defined. So if in fact the details of the Swedish mutation were not discovered until after Dr. Mullen was in Florida, then the fact that all of this collaboration had been taking place, how does that affect inventorship?
The Athena Oil and Vanderbilt cases make clear that a co-inventor need not have a mental picture of the full and complete structure of the ultimate molecule in order to make a significant contribution to that conception. And because otherwise you could never have joint inventors. Each individual inventor would have to be a sole inventor of the invention. And here it's kind of like the situation. You would not suggest that the roughneck who drills an oil well and has a gusher come out of it is the sole discoverer and owner to the exclusion of the people who told him where to dig the well. And the people who told them where to dig the well in this case were Hardy and Mullen, and certainly Hardy, and that was amply corroborated by the testimony of Holden, by the testimony of Duff, who said that Mullen told her that they knew there was a mutation in that DNA before they ever sent it to Florida, and by the plan to make sure that the final sequencing was done.
I'm not so sure. The evolution of the law here, when it was known that it was a mutation, was known that there were the Swedish families who carried the mutation, and until that specific mutation in the DNA in the sequence was identified, was there an invention?
The fact that there was Alzheimer's disease in the Swedish family did not mean that it was a mutation in the amyloid gene. That was exactly what Dr. Hardy was trying to find out. That's why they did the analysis with GT12, which is uniquely intended to determine whether it's in the amyloid gene. And Dr. Hardy got that analysis back, and he was the kind of scientist who would look at that and by eye, experienced scientist, say all of the affected people have this mutation. It seems to be being inherited, the disease, with this copy of the gene. I conclude that there's likely an amyloid mutation causing this disease. And because I don't want Imperial to own it, I'm going to send it to Dr. Mullen, along with the GT12 data, which could only be used for analyzing linkage to amyloid, and in order to have it sequenced outside the university, in accordance with the basic plan back from the Athena agreement that said in those circumstances, that's what you did. So that is a contribution to the conception. That's Dr. Hardy telling you where to drill the well. Now, did he know there was oil there? He thought it likely that there was oil there, enough to commit the resources of his laboratory to actually do that experiment. Now, neither Dr. Hardy nor Dr. Mullen knew before Fiona Crawford showed up and actually did the experiment where exactly that DNA mutation was or what exactly it was. Yet there's no dispute that Dr. Mullen is a co-inventor and Dr. Hardy is everyone.
Why? Because if I were to understand and accept the facts that you just alleged, it seems that Mr. Mullen is the ruffian who drilled the well where Dr. Hardy told him to. You just said there's no dispute that Mr. Mullen is a co-inventor, yet under your definition of inventorship, if I accept it, Dr. Hardy did all the inventing and all Mr. Mullen did was test the sample and reach the conclusion Dr. Hardy surmised was there all along.
There, to carry the analogy forward, and I'm uncomfortable advocating my adversary's position, but I will do so. There were two types of analyses that were done to determine where to drill the well. Dr. Hardy used his experience and judgment in the pattern in the GT12 analysis. Dr. Mullen did a very sophisticated computer-based analysis of the data, which calculated this logarithm of the odds number, which was an indication of whether there was likely linkage. And those two together are what dictated where to drill the well.
Does it matter to your case whether it's a question of joint ownership or whether, as suggested by Judge Moore, it was actually Dr. Hardy who was the inventor?
Well, we did not try the issue of whether Dr. Mullen was not an inventor at all, but it would not matter to my case at all if that were the determination.
Why?
If Mullen were not an inventor, then he could not have conveyed to AIA any rights to sue on this patent, and there would be no standing.
Why not? Because there was no patent.
No, because he was not the inventor, and therefore the assignment that he executed, assigning his inchoate rights, conveyed nothing.
He had no rights to convey.
But the inventorship can be corrected, can it not, at this stage?
It theoretically could. I agree with Mr. Marshall. I think it's entirely unlikely.
And unless there were motives, the record hints at all sorts of motives might, I suppose, inhibit correction, but I'm not, that certainly was not developed.
That is correct. That was
the
not.
Statute it, clearly requires no bad motive. Is that right? I don't remember.
Not any longer, actually.
For an action commenced today under the AIA, the deceptive intention requirement has been eliminated.
Okay.
But it does require concerted application by all parties. It seems to me I'd love to be in the room when Hardy and Mullen and AI and all of the others were going to jointly file the application for correction. It seems that popcorn would be in order to watch that negotiation.
I would agree, Your Honor. It might be a slasher movie. So.
What are the consequences, Mr. Lipsy, to your position if the jury verdict is upheld, that there was a joint inventorship issue at this stage of the case? Where does that leave you, and where does that moot all the other issues? Where are we?
We struggled with this issue, where there are two independent bases for determining that there is no standing. What should the court do? And we did find, it seems to be in the discretion of the court what to do, we did find one case where both were dealt with, and I would urge the court to deal with both now, because we don't want to be back in court sometime later in case something happens to move one of the other issues. And that was this Sakalor versus United States, 815 F2nd 1488.
Say that again.
815 F2nd 1488.
Okay.
Not a patent case, but for the idea that there were two arguments there for why there was no standing.
Would we read something that wasn't a patent case?
yes, of course.
Okay. What court was that?
That was from this court.
I guess I'm still confused. Help me. You heard my questions to opposing counsel. How can the conclusion that there has to be joint inventorship result in no standing? Because if that were true, I'm just finding it difficult to understand our prior 102F cases, which decided invalidity. Like, how could you ever invalidate a patent under 102F if really the result when you decide there's a missing inventor is no standing? You see where I'm going?
I see where you're going.
It's no standing, it's invalidity, if you're correct about the facts. So, I mean, maybe there's no standing based on the ownership. That's a separate question. But to the extent that this court concluded there was no standing by virtue of the jury's determination that Hardy ought to be a co-inventor, I'm struggling with that because that feels to me like a ground for invalidation, but not a ground for lack of standing.
This may seem like a fine distinction, but one sees it in the reported cases. When you're dealing with standing, you're not really talking about the defense to that the patent is invalid or something like that. What you're saying is, all I'm looking at is, does this person who has come in here as the party plaintiff have the appropriate title and rights and are the appropriate people here in court to even get off the ground in this lawsuit? And that's what the court decided. The court decided, no, there's another joint inventor here who's got rights. AIA doesn't control them. They don't have the right people here, and this suit has to be dismissed. It leaves for another day what might happen if they, for example, which is why we urge the court to reach both these issues. If the court didn't, and whatever the issue was undone, we were back in court having
but
to litigate it.
But inventorship isn't a question of title. And the jury just found he's a co-inventor.
Correct. But what that meant was that there was an owner, according to AIA's theory, the instant he conceived the invention, there was an owner whose rights AIA didn't have and who had not joined as a party plaintiff. And it implicates, at a minimum, prudential standing in that you shouldn't go off and litigate one of these issues unless you have all of the stakeholders there. Now, are there ways that you could perhaps deal with that? I know Judge Newman has addressed ways that you might deal with that in the Ethicon case. They seem unlikely at this point for the reasons Mr. Marshall noted.
Any more questions? No,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, Mr. Lipsy talked about that Hardy glanced at the data by eye believed that there was linkage, and so he told Mullen where to drill the well, told him where to sequence. And that's where there is a complete failure of proof, Your Honor. Even Hardy was not able to testify that he ever told Mullen where to drill the well. He repeatedly said, I don't recall ever saying that. I don't recall ever telling Mullen that there was linkage. I don't recall ever telling Mullen that you should sequence amyloid. Henry Holden, who was put up as a corroborating witness, also testified that he never recalled telling Mullen those things. He never recalled hearing John Hardy tell Mullen those things.
But is transferring the DNA samples the equivalent? Because what else would be the point of the DNA samples with the suggested sequencing to occur?
Because they were moving the lab to Florida, and because...
So let me just pluck out these ones and have you sequence them, because the rest are coming, but these are just randomly selected to move first.
There were many DNA samples moved to Florida, and the research plan that was written in January of 1992, just a couple of months before this discovery was made, basically said that we're going to create a genomic library so that we can do linkage studies for areas other than APP, areas other than the amyloid gene. Dr. Mullen was the genetic linkage expert. He was the person who was experienced with actually wrote some of the software that calculated the genetic
linkage. Didn't Mr. Holden testify that Hardy told him to give these exact DNA samples from the Swedish family to Mullen for sequencing?
Yes, Your Honor, he did testify to that. But what was never testified to was any communication to Dr. Mullen. The DNA was sent along with a lot of other DNA. The family pedigrees were sent along with a lot of other family pedigrees. The genetic analysis, the GT12 data, was sent. But there was no communication to Mullen, you should sequence on the amyloid gene. And in fact, the research plans talk about them looking for mutations in areas other than the amyloid gene. And that's what Dr. Mullen was expert at, was finding genetic linkage. That's what he did. So if you're going to send something to someone to just sequence the amyloid gene, why do you send the data? Why do you send it to Dr. Mullen, who's not a sequencer? He is a genetic linkage expert. That's what he does. He was sent the DNA, it's our position, and the data, because Dr. Hardy didn't find linkage with the amyloid gene, which is what he said in 1992. So we now have a witness who's coming in saying the exact opposite thing 20 years later, and there is no evidence whatsoever in the record that he communicated any alleged conclusions to Dr. Mullen. Without that communication, there cannot be joint inventorship.
One quick question, because I know your time is over. Mr. Lipsey said all the patents at issue are expired. I thought there was a more recent continuation. Is that not at issue in this case?
There was a more recent continuation, Your Honor, but I believe that one has expired
as well
now.
Okay.
Yes.
The transgenic mice one.
Correct.
Okay, just want to be clear.
Yes.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Lipsey, the case is taken under submission.